Hello and welcome to The Wire, your independent national coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Amina Shakur, coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. And today on the show...
How are we supposed to trust that this person is making decisions that are at our best interest as disabled people when accessibility isn't a priority even in within their own space and their own office?
A disability advocate couldn't access the disability minister's office, sparking outrage.
Absolutely critical that the Albanese government work with the Australian Parliament to create a strong set of national nature laws.
New report highlights one third of Australian mature forests only remain. And later today...
And so they can fall through the cracks so easily when they don't fit in any of those systems. And that's what we end up with, is people on the streets. And
we look into homelessness in Brisbane, breaking down the widespread misconceptions and misinformation. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. A disability advocate has called out the federal government after another campaigner, Shane Hirohak, was unable to access Disability Minister Mark Butler's Port Adelaide office. Jasmine Scriven, founder of Babes with Mobility Aids, says the incident highlights the gap between political talk on inclusion and the everyday reality of inaccessibility. I asked Jasmine what went through her mind when she first heard that a disability advocate couldn't even get into the disability minister's office.
Look, I would say that I was surprised, but to be honest, I wasn't really. I think just knowing where our government is at the moment with disability reform in general, with, you know, the NDIS changes, I think knowing all of that kind of made it not so surprising that this was something that we had to deal with. But it is, at the same time, very disappointing.
You've mentioned heritage buildings are often used as like an excuse. What should the government do when a building design kind of limits accessibility?
Well, in this case, I believe that the office is rented, so it should be of the utmost priority to find a different building, the one that is more accessible and meets the needs of these constituents. Because I think, you know, I understand previously that this has been his office since before he was appointed as the disability minister. So, you know, I can understand why perhaps it wasn't as big of a priority previously, but now that he's taken on this role and he's representing us as a community, I think it needs to be much more of a priority to either move offices or make the efforts to make the existing space accessible.
How common are situations like this for people with disability?
Very common. I think people who do not have lived experience don't necessarily understand what true accessibility looks like. I think, you know, the general understanding is a step-free entrance, and it doesn't really go much further than that. But I think, you know, what needs to perhaps be made more, increasing awareness around it is that accessibility is much more, it's much more deep than that. We've got, you know, we need to be able to move independently without the help of others through a space in order for it to be fully accessible. So for that, you know, if we're looking at things like even stair lifts in shops, they're not necessarily fully accessible because you have to get the help of someone else to operate it. It's considering all the different things that make accessibility, you know, what it is. So, for example, if I went into a clothing shop and yes, I could get through the door and that, you know, that part's accessible, but it doesn't necessarily mean that I can actually, you know, navigate through the aisles independently. They might be too narrow. There might not be enough turning space for me. I think they're, you know, it's a very common thing that we experience. I think we all take the label of accessible with a grain of salt because it's very rare that a space is actually fully accessible.
What message does it send to people with disability when government workplaces fail like basic accessibility standards?
Well, I think in this case, it just shows us that this, you know, how are we supposed to trust that this person is making decisions that are at our best interests as disabled people when accessibility isn't a priority even within their own space and their own office? I think it's frustrating for us as a community, you know, knowing that we often get left behind in different circumstances, and, you know, other politicians may not be as well-versed in the disability space and the accessibility space, but the fact that it's the disability minister who does not see this as a priority and is not making, you know, obvious steps towards making his office more accessible to the constituents that he serves, I think, unfortunately, you know, it says a lot about perhaps where his priorities are and whether he has our best interests at heart.
Speaking about politicians, what does leadership on accessibility look like to you?
It looks like, you know, centering disabled voices. I think so often decisions are made without us, and they're made without proper consultation, and they're made based on assumptions that, you know, I think that this is what needs to happen because that's my understanding of disability, but without actually speaking to the people that it affects. I think that there needs to be much more consultation in all areas of disability and government with the people that it actually affects. We see it a lot with the NDIS at the moment. They're making a lot of changes that the vast majority of disabled people are not in support of. And, you know, it shows that if they were actually consulting with our communities in these decisions that they're making that impact our lives, that, you know, we wouldn't have such massive issues and, you know, such massive uproar from our community based on some of these decisions. I think, you know, it's that whole thing, nothing about us without us. We need to make sure that, you know, we have a seat at those tables, and, you know, we can't have a seat at those tables if the office isn't accessible. I think it's important that we recognise that this is just one sort of small part of a much bigger issue in this country, and I think it's important that we continue to raise awareness of, you know, what accessibility looks like, how that manifests in different areas, but also, you know, how we can address it and how we can include disabled people in the conversation.
That was Jasmine Sreevan, founder of Babes with Mobility Aid and disability advocate, speaking to The Wire. A new report from the Australian Conservation Foundation has revealed that only a third of Australia's mature forests remain. The ACF says weak nature laws and deforestation loopholes are allowing the destruction of vital habitats to continue unchecked. I spoke with acting ACF CEO Dr. Paul Sinclair about what action needs to be taken.
Australia is the only developed nation that is seen as a deforestation hotspot, which is a real tragedy. And that's driven by two things. One's the logging that occurs in the big wet forests that run down the mountains of southeast Australia into Tasmania. And then there's hundreds of thousands of hectares of bush that is cleared for agriculture to grow pasture. Very small number of businesses clear a massive amount of bush, like up to 500,000 hectares. A hectare is about as big as a footy oval. They clear 500,000 hectares a year. So that's really a massive loss. It releases an enormous amount of carbon pollution into the atmosphere. It destroys habitat for species like koalas. It makes the land hotter. It causes runoff to run into the lagoon of the Great Barrier Reef that then contributes to the destruction of the reef. So, yeah, it's not a good thing.
34.7% of Australia's mature forests still remain. How urgent is it to take action right now?
It's absolutely critical that the Albanese government work with the Australian Parliament to create a strong set of national nature laws that close the deforestation loophole. A strong nature laws will create a strong Australia, and they have to get stuck into that right away.
What reforms do you believe would have the most immediate impact in halting that deforestation?
There's a number of reforms that need to be made that all work together. We need to have strong national rules that define the standards that need to be delivered by the Act. That just is a complicated way of saying the Act needs to create environmental outcomes. It needs to create more bush than gets knocked down, and that needs to be really clear in the new nature law. We need a new National Environment Protection Agency, which the government has committed to doing. It's not as independent as we would like, but it is going to be focused on enforcing the rules and making the law work. And the two areas where are really critical is that we need to make sure that deforestation loopholes are closed, and that's going to require those national standards that create more nature than's knocked down to apply to what's known as regional forest agreements that govern the logging industry in southeastern Australia. And we need to get really serious on making sure that bush that is in agricultural land that has been there for 15 years or longer is protected, and that the EPA keeps a really close eye on what clearing is going on and enforces the law.
How can we protect nature without, I guess, hurting jobs relying on it?
About half the Australian economy is directly dependent on nature. About $900 billion worth of economic activity is directly dependent on nature. So many Australian jobs are already reliant on nature and are being put at risk by us undermining the natural wealth of our country. So we need to make sure that we protect nature, because when we do that, we'll create a strong economy and a strong country. Where there are changes that need to be made in industries that have traditionally been based on whether it's logging or other sectors, we need to ensure that workers who are in those industries are treated fairly and equitably if there is a need to transition out of those industries.
That was ACF Acting CEO Paul Sinclair speaking to The Wire. You're listening to The Wire on Community and Indigenous Radio. I'm Amini Shakur in Melbourne. A big hello to our listeners in Alice Springs on 8CCC 102.1 FM, and to our friends in Noosa on Noosa FM 101.3, and to the other side of the country to Radio Gulari in Broome, Western Australia. In Brisbane, homelessness is becoming increasingly visible, yet the conversation around its causes and realities oftentimes seems misinformed. Head of the Northwest Community Group, Paul Slater, works on the front lines of this crisis. The Wise Artem Rednikin spoke to him about the misconceptions around why people become homeless and what stops them from getting the support they need.
That's the million-dollar question, and I think it's the one that's really hard to answer in a short, you know, interview. Like, we could do a two-hour episode on our podcast on just this question alone, because the system is extremely siloed, every part of the system. So the health system's in one spot, the housing system's in another spot, and then the mental health system's in another spot, and they don't coexist and work together to see a wraparound system for somebody. And so they can fall through the cracks so easily when they don't fit in any of those systems. And that's what we end up with, is people on the streets. And unfortunately, when you get on the streets, after 1 week or 2 weeks, that's when the slope begins. And it's so dangerous for your mental health and your physical health to be sleeping rough that I've seen it week on week, the actual visible drop in mental health and physical health from people when they're sleeping rough is alarming. And so that's when the longer we let them stay there, the more chance that they're going to stay there long term. And I always say to people that have become rough sleepers to straight away work as fast as they can to connect with services, find solutions, and get off the streets, because the longer that they're there, the more chance they'll be there for another 5 years or 10 years.
It's not uncommon to hear people say that there are enough support services out there available for people sleeping rough. What would you say to that?
I think even I would have said something like that before I got involved in this work. I would have been like, it's Australia. If someone's sleeping rough, it's because they want to do that, or they've made a decision to do that. And I think I think that's naive for a couple of reasons. One is that I know that there's many, many rough sleepers out there. In fact, I know the majority of the rough sleepers would jump at the chance for accommodation. So that's just not true. But there are a small portion that you would probably say to you if you walked up to them and said, hey, I can get you accommodation. They say, no, I'm okay here. I think there's an argument to say that if someone thinks that, then they probably have some mental health issues or something that's going there that they haven't received the support that they need, or that they've had trauma in their life again that they haven't been able to do it. You know, we've met homeless people that say, my son died when he was younger and it was my fault and I punished myself. I don't deserve to have a home because of that, and that's why I sleep rough, you know, things like that. People get passed around. Like, they'll say, you know, they'll contact me and go, hey, I'm worried I'm going to become homeless. And then they'll contact the homeless hotline, who will say, go and talk to these people. And then they'll say, oh, no, you need to talk to these people. And then they'll say, you need to talk to this people. And so what ends up happening is you say your story over and over and over again. And sometimes you're reliving a fairly traumatic story that you don't want to be saying over and over again, but you need to. And that affects their mental health as well. And so after a while, they just go, oh, bugger this. I'm sick of saying the same story. I'm sick of doing this. Just don't talk to me anymore. And of course, that's the ones that the system say, you know, they're not cooperating and they're refusing accommodation and all that kind of stuff. But there's usually much more to the story than that.
So what would you say are some of the challenges rough sleepers encounter while trying to access the services that are available for them?
There's no one person or one entity you can go to that will say, hey, I see you're in a really, really bad space right now and that you need multiple areas of support. I'll get that sorted for you. I'll get you there. I'll tell you where to be, what time to be there. I'll make sure you've got somewhere to sleep for now, and then we'll work on all these issues. They don't do that. What they do is they say, well, I can do this one specific little thing, but you need to go over here to do this, and you need to go. So they're trying to catch public transport to get around town and get to different places, and you know, they're not getting a decent night's sleep because they can't, because they're sleeping rough. And so, you know, it just, inevitably they're going to miss appointments, and then they'll get kicked out of it because they missed appointments. And you know, so yeah, it really does. I say it all the time, the system sets them up to fail. Doors don't open for these people, they close, and you know, it makes it very hard. Like, you know, we can talk about addiction issues and rehabs and stuff for ages because that's so broken as well. There's a 12-week, 13-week wait to get into a rehab when you're sleeping rough, and they expect you, some of those rehabs expect you to detox while you're sleeping rough before they'll let you in. You can't be an active user when you go in. Like, that's just not realistic and not based on medical science and stuff like that. We just know that that's unlikely to happen and it's not going to work, and yet we continue to tell them that they've got to do that.
Is there anything in the public attitude towards homelessness that needs to change?
You get a mixed bag, you know. You get a lot of people that are very compassionate. The people obviously that support what I do are very compassionate people, but you do have a large portion of the population who do believe that homelessness is their own fault and that they just should get a job and that'll sort out their problems and that they're responsible and, you know, everything like that. And I think that's the wrong conversation to be having. I think everybody at some stage in their life needs help, and we need to look at how we've helped these people and how we can better help these people, because I know from personal experience, if you can connect with these people and you can provide the support that they want, then they will flourish and they will be able to get out of the situation that they're in. But we just don't connect with most of these guys.
Paul Slater from the Northwest Community Group in Brisbane there, speaking with the Wise Artem Rednikin. A new program in Queensland regional area will help youth to gain skills to become employable. In Gympie, north of Sunshine Coast, the unemployment rates and youth disengagement are above average because they struggle with the traditional education system and environmental factors. The Get Set to Work program, provided by the non-for-profit STEPS, includes a nationally recognized training and support services for this cohort. The program is also free for Australians aged 15 to 19. The Wise Artem Rednikin asked CEO of STEPS, Casey Stanley, to explain more about STEPS.
So STEPS is a national non-for-profit organisation that helps people to develop skills for work and life. So So we basically provide opportunities for individuals within communities to build their capacity in whether it, if they're looking for a job, whether they need to learn life skills, we do that. We've been in the Sunshine Coast since 1987, and we offer education and training programs across the community services area, and we concentrate on language, literacy, and numeracy in that capacity building across Australia. Our mission is to help people to step into a world of opportunity and empower to take positive steps forward in their lives. What we're really passionate about is focusing on helping people overcome barriers so that they can sustain employment or they can comfortably live in the community and have that community connection.
What's the Steps Get Set to Work program and who gets the benefits of it?
Steps Get Set to Work is a hands-on program, and it's designed for our 15 to 19 cohort who may have disengaged from school for different reasons, maybe struggling with understanding what their pathway is moving forward. It's for that young person that really just does not like going to school, but we need to get them into doing something so they don't get stuck inside the house. It helps participants become more confident and develop employability skills whilst developing their language, literacy, and numeracy and communication skills. So through the program, they learn in a supportive, inclusive environment that will value their progress. So it's about understanding where they're at and then working to where they want to be. Our participants will benefit directly through a personalised mentoring system. So they have a trainer, but they also have a mentor that supports them with what's going on outside of the classroom. And we try and scaffold all of the things that we learn with social emotional wellbeing support. We like to work with local employers and community to provide work experience. Our aim is either to get the young person back to school and feeling confident in school or into an employment.
For listeners who are unfamiliar, Gympie is close to the Sunshine Coast. So why is the program so critical in this particular region?
In Gympie, I see it's much like a lot of our regional areas. Unemployment, particularly youth unemployment and youth disengagement rates, are quite high. They're higher than average. Many people lack the face support. And our young people face barriers that we forget that they are facing. So housing instability with their home, limited access to education and training options, or the thought that they can't get into the different programs because they didn't finish school. In Gympie, we're trying to fill a gap by providing a structured, a support that's close to home that they can build their own being, build on their capacity to be able to see past all of the barriers that they feel they have.
What are the challenges youth in the area face when trying to reconnect with learning specifically?
That low academic confidence, it's that feeling of not being able to be successful in a classroom because they haven't been before. It's the anxiety of going back into a school because they've had those negative school experiences. The limited access to transport, internet, the support systems that you need when you're learning, mental health and those wellbeing challenges. Our young people don't know always how to support themselves through those sorts of challenges, and that's becoming bigger and bigger across our regional areas. Obviously, there's a difficulty of them seeing that clear link between education and what the real world outcomes are, employment. You know, you often hear young people go, oh, what am I going to use that for when I get out into my job? It's bringing that link back into their world, I suppose, so they can understand that. We address these challenges through the small class sizes, we provide mentoring, provide practical learning, but then we also have the ability to provide some financial wraparound support for to overcome some of these barriers.
Have you received any feedback from young people about the program, and what are some of the success outcomes you've seen in them?
I'm really lucky because I get to go to graduations every 8 to 10 weeks for different programs across the region. What is the most beautiful part is the parents. The parents thanking us for seeing their children get out of the house 4 days a week and successfully complete a qualification, something they never thought they would be able to do. We've seen young people go back to school. We've also seen young people gain and go on to working employment and going then to TAFE to do their first certificate of schooling through the TAFE system. So as I said earlier, it's all about that personalised journey and working out what's going to be best for the young person. Some kids have gone into disability support qualifications through us, and some have wanted to further their literacy skills and have done the skills for education and employment through STEPS as well.
My final question is, where can young people get information about this program?
So basically by visiting the STEPS Get Set for Work webpage at stepsgroup.com.au, or easily just contacting the 1300 number, which is 1300 131 965.
That was CEO of STEPS, Casey Stanley, speaking with the WISE Artem Rednikin. And unfortunately, that is the end of today's show. Thanks so much for listening wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations, 2SER in Sydney, Radio Adelaide, 4ZZZ, and Radio 4EB in Brisbane, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and Community Radio Network. Check out all of our stories on our website at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook, X, Instagram, and LinkedIn. The Wire acknowledges the Wurundjeri Woi Wurrung people of the Kulin Nations, the traditional custodians of the lands where the program is produced, and we pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. I'm Amina Shakur, coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.